Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, November 24th, 2024. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with the front page article from the Republic entitled, How Native Art is Changing from Beads to Computers, with the subtitle, Native Art Has a Rich History, but Young Artists Want to Expand Its Roots and Move Things in Different Directions. This is by Deborah Utasia Kroll. Liz Romero had purchased a selection of beaded wallets from a native wholesaler, planning to sell them in her small art shop and display some of them at a local powwow in October. She had been assured they were authentic, the work of native artists, but they were bogus, counterfeit. Romero got the bad news at the powwow from several people who saw the items, including the chairman of her own tribe, the Redding Rancheria in Northern California. She immediately removed the wallets from her table. Romero buys handmade items from Native artists across the West, and she'd bought these, the wallets, some earrings, and necklaces, from a Native artist from Bloomfield, New Mexico. "I never thought to question him on the wallets," she said. Romero did some research and found that the wallets, offered for sale on Amazon, are made by Indians, but not from the U.S., from India. Adding insult to injury, the Amazon wallets were priced at $35, and she paid $70 to the purported artist. Romero said the earrings she accepted as authentic turned out to be offered on Temu, another aggregator site. She told her story on Facebook and refunded buyers of the counterfeit items, absorbed the cost, and placed them in a section of her store reserved for imported and non-native-made items. "The sad part," she said, "is that my little business thrives off a good deal or a purchase that would make me money, and this is the second time someone's got me." What happened to Romero happens often to native artists, many of whom rely on sales of their creations to put food on the table, pay for gas and utilities, and clothes on their kids' backs. But contending with a tsunami of cheaper, fraudulent art is just one challenge in a world where native artists must navigate a knot of sellers, dealers, museum operators, and other gatekeepers who have long tried to define native art, pushing artists to make what sells. Apache artist Douglas Miles calls it the Native American Industrial Arts Complex, which is currently locked in a struggle between the natural growth of arts over the years and the pressure on Indian artists to continue producing saleable traditional pieces, even if it's not the art they want to make. From kitchen tables strewn with beads, basketry materials, or wood shavings, to Laguna Pueblo artist Pat Pruitt's huge studio packed with computers loaded with graphic software, CNC milling machines, drills, lathes, and welding equipment, some artists question how their art is perceived by collectors, galleries, museums, and the public. They ask how the art scene evolved to where it is now, and why so many artists don't have the same regard and access to mainstream galleries and museums as their non-Indigenous peers. At the same time, they're dealing with a flood of counterfeit pieces that undercut their prices and their incomes. Artists question why gatekeepers, primarily non-Indians, dictate what is shown in museums and offered on shop shelves. They increasingly ask who determines what is art versus craft. And they chafe at lingering ideas among some in the business about whether art is Indian enough. Some artists' work was initially rejected for this reason. Some are moving toward marketing and presenting art through new venues such as direct marketing, supported by some nonprofit arts and entrepreneur support groups. Others continue using the market museum gallery circuit because they have bills to pay and kids to put through college, or simply because it's the path they know and are comfortable with. They also question the integrity of some long-time non-Indian businesses like the well-known Gilbert Ortega shops. Native artists winced 2 years ago when Gilbert Ortega Jr. accosted Native performers in front of his Old Town Scottsdale store during a Super Bowl promotion. However, a growing number of artists are moving away from these traditional pathways to carve their own roads to success. Artists such as Pruitt, photographer Cara Romero, multimedia artist Anna Soularakis and the Cotone brothers, weaver Marlo and Yancey, a muralist and tattoo artist, wield ever-evolving materials and techniques to create new forms or reinterpret old forms and motifs. They are bursting through the box of what some collectors, curators, and more traditional artists believe Indigenous art should fit into. At least one, Passamaquoddy basket maker Jeremy Frey, literally set the box ablaze, emerging to achieve international acclaim. From no word for art to one of Indian country's biggest industries. At the Heard Museum in Phoenix last March, artists unloaded beadwork and baskets, paintings, pottery and photography, jewelry, stone and wood sculptures, textiles and delicate works in glass. Artists or consigners completed entry forms while workers ensured each piece or set was in one of eight categories, ready for judges to examine, discuss, and sometimes dissect that evening. It was juried competition day at the Heard Museum Guild Indian Fair and Market, the country's second largest Indigenous art showplace. Each artist had applied in advance with detailed photos of their work to be adjudicated. Once they passed, they paid a booth fee ranging from $250 to $1,200. With travel and lodging costs, artists often pony up as much as $3,000 for a two-day window to show their works and make enough money to last until the next market. Winning a ribbon and the check that goes with it, the top prize this year was $25,000, boosts the artist's career and their bottom line. The Heard Fair and other major Indian art markets, museum shops, and galleries, mostly overseen by non-Indians, have long accounted for a major portion of Native artists' annual revenues. But while pursuing the hundreds of pieces for sale outside the galleries, visitors to the Heard can see ancestral Pueblo pottery from the Four Corners decorated with cultural motifs like rain, clouds, and family symbols. Cotton strands spun and dyed with natural dyes nearly 1,000 years old are artfully draped over the small storage pot in which they were rediscovered, left behind by the people who prepared them as they searched for a more reliable source of water more than 800 years ago. Another display of the first peoples of the Salt River Valley, the Hohokam, features pottery nearly as old, as well as small effigies. One piece with inlaid turquoise chips showed how the ancestors of the Odum adorned themselves. But one thing these and other Indigenous peoples have in common, they have no word for art. These pieces expressed cultural values, visualized beneficial weather or environmental conditions, or depicted spiritual purposes. What was once created for utilitarian, cultural, or religious purposes caught the eye of settlers eager to visit Indian country, creating a market for what is now called art. First American Art Magazine, one of the first publications owned and operated by Native people, published a timeline of Indigenous art history in the Americas that denoted how the Native art world has changed over the centuries. From cultural touchstone to commodity. After contact and colonization, Spanish settlers brought the practice of silversmithing to the Southwest in the late 19th century. Two of the best-known early jewelers were at Sidi Sani, believed to be one of the first Diné silversmiths, and Slender, or Slim, maker of silver, the patriarch of the Peshlakai family, who's known as the first artist to have an assembly line of silversmiths more than 10 years before Henry Ford. Navajo, Zuni, and other Native silversmiths who took up the trade first worked in silver melted down from coins. They later added turquoise, sparking a sea change in how people around the Four Corners created items for sale or to build wealth out of silver and stones. Zunis had worked with cut stone earlier on and quickly adapted to the new techniques. The Spanish-influenced jewelry soon joined more traditional pottery, weavings, and carvings, as a way for native people to obtain canned food, metalware, and even horses and buggies. At the same time, native people started producing jewelry and other items for sale, and trading posts run by government-licensed traders sprang up in and near tribal communities. Traders learned to operate on a barter system, according to the book Fred Harvey Jewelry, 1900 to 1955, by the late Dennis June, himself a longtime trader. Indians wanted not only durable goods, but brilliantly dyed commercial yarns, and of course, silver coins that could be melted down for more jewelry. Lorenzo Hubble, who operated a trading post in Ganado, is said to be the first to encourage Navajo women to make rugs instead of blankets, since he had a storeroom of colorful, commercially made wool trade blankets and didn't need more. Weavers quickly started creating Oriental-style rugs in traditional Navajo motifs, and a new art form was born. Some trading posts were operated by families, and at least one maintained their tradition. The McGees and their in-laws have been running trading posts for more than 100 years since acquiring the Keams Canyon Trading Post from Lorenzo Hubble. Joyce June, Dennis's widow, and her cousin, Bruce McGee, used to run the hills around Keams Canyon. Her parents moved to Hopi after marrying and lived without running water or electric service. After Joyce met and married Trader Dennis, the Junes opened up their own gallery in Scottsdale's Old Town District. Dennis became fascinated with Fred Harvey-era jewelry and researched his book for 10 years, she said. He bought a collection, which is what started it all, Joyce said. There was always a question about the souvenir jewelry, and so this book explains how it was all produced. Dennis died in 2021, and June kept the gallery going until April. Like June, Bruce McGee grew up surrounded by Native people and the art they created. "I blame Joyce's dad for getting me into the business," McGee said. "He was my mentor." But William McGee, Joyce's dad, only had daughters, and he wanted a son. He persuaded his brother to name his new son William B. McGee, known as Bruce for short. Bruce and his cousins, including June, split their childhoods between the Hopi Mesas and the city of Mesa. "I wish every kid could grow up like I did," McGee said. "Race wasn't an issue. There was no difference between one person and another." His mom put on banquets and programs in the community, and some Hopi ladies became grandmas. "Race became an issue when the McGees moved to Holbrook. The kids teased me because I had this accent," he said. But McGee's first exposure to the trading post business came shortly after he married. "My dad had me working with him at the Pinyon Trading Post, even though I couldn't speak a word of Navajo," he said. Dad worked the young McGee hard and pressured him to do well. "We opened when the sun came up and closed when the sun went down. If a local resident needed supplies after closing time, McGee was expected to open the store. So, McGee asked if he could make another trader, Billy Malone, his boss instead. The experience changed his life. He learned the trade from the patient Malone, which led to a more than 70-year career in Indian art, including directing the Heard Museum shop. McGee retired from the Heard this year." Fred Harvey's Indian Rooms and the Start of Indian Markets. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, the Santa Fe Railway stretched its metal fingers across the nation, giving birth to not only rapid transcontinental travel, but to a growing middle-class pursuit, tourism. Restaurateur Fred Harvey's hospitality empire, which grew to include not only restaurants but also hotels, guided tours, and retail, launched its Indian department in 1902. The Indian Rooms and the Fred Harvey Indian Building in Albuquerque, New Mexico, offered a variety of native pieces from the Navajo weavings to Pueblo pottery, native jewelry, and other pieces. Indigenous art collector and dealer Herman Schweizer was given the task of stocking the venues with enticing items. Indigenous artisans and entrepreneurs readily adapted to the influx of visitors, including the Laguna Pueblo, whose land was bisected by the railroad. Laguna artist Pat Pruitt said that Laguna pottery became more elaborate and commodified almost instantaneously. The railroad single-handedly created an environment and an industry just by its presence, he said. Our people were able to design, develop, and produce ceramic ware that had symbology on it that was representative of who we are. We didn't really think twice about it. It just happened, and no one questioned it. Back in Albuquerque, Schweizer dealt with customer complaints that the heavy silver and stone jewelry prized by Navajos and other Southwestern indigenous peoples as portable wealth was too heavy for slender tourist necks and wrists. Schweizer approached his silversmith sources and asked them to make their pieces lighter with thinner silver stock. The big hunks of turquoise preferred by Navajos shrunk in size or disappeared entirely. He presented silversmiths with a line of preferred stamp designs like arrows, thunderbirds, teepees, although no Southwestern tribe ever used the conical hide homes, snakes, and arrowheads. Collectors can be particularly startled by one symbol in the Harvey palette of stampings, the Nahokos or whirling log, also known as the swastika. Once the Nazis appropriated the symbol for well-being and protection, Native people mostly quit using it until recently when they felt it was time to reclaim their symbols. The birth of the Native American industrial art complex. One of the biggest problems is that we Native people allowed white collectors, curators, and academics to define our work in the 1920s and 30s, said Douglas Miles, an artist and designer who heads up Apache Skateboards. Miles' statement is rooted in the actions of agency heads, art impresarios, and museum staff in the 20th century. John Collier became head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1933 when the nation was in the throes of the Great Depression. Tribes were in even worse shape, and Collier, a social justice advocate, instituted several reforms to federal Indian policy. One of those policies involved the role art played in sustaining Native cultures that previous federal administrations had suppressed. Collier was really concerned about the fact that ceremonies or dancing were being suppressed, said Jennifer McLaren, scholar, curator, and author of the book A New Deal for Native Art, Indian Arts and Federal Policy, 1933 to 1943. Collier held a romanticized view of indigenous cultures and was also familiar with the Miriam Report, which detailed the federal government's failures in dealing with tribes and the dire conditions in tribal communities. The report also tied arts and handcrafts to ceremony and religion. Although Collier was extremely interested in supporting cultural continuance, and wanted Native peoples to determine their own destiny, McLaren said. He also wanted them to remain in their traditional communities and carry on with their indigenous ways of life. Tourism posed an issue with Collier. Through the 1910s and 20s, the Hopi snake dance was huge, she said. People flocked to the mesas to observe the dance. He became very concerned about how American tourism was affecting the spiritual and ceremonial life, especially of the Hopi and a number of Pueblo groups. Tourism also had a significant impact on the quality of art produced by tribal people. Just as the Fred Harvey Company learned, tourists wanted small objects they could travel with and could easily acquire. They weren't very expensive, McLaren said. At the same time, art curator Renee Darnoncourt, who worked with folk artists in Mexico, was interested in generating better quality art to offer collectors. Collier was also friends with the Hubble trading family, known for their marketing expertise. Son Roman Hubble was the mastermind behind creating the world's largest Navajo rug, now on display at the Afelt Mian Museum at the La Posada Hotel in Winslow, to attract tourists to the family's Winslow trading post. Hubble was trying to generate this very, very upscale, wealthy market in the 1930s, McLaren said. Collier was instrumental in establishing the Indian Arts and Crafts Board within the Department of the Interior in 1935 to promote and preserve native material culture. Darnancourt came on board as an administrator. While at the Indian Arts and Crafts Board, Darnancourt organized one of the first national exhibits of Native arts at the Golden Gate International Exposition in San Francisco in 1939. And in 1941, Darnancourt and Denver Art Museum curator Frederick H. Douglass mounted the exhibit Indian Art of the United States at New York City's Museum of Modern Art. McLaren said these grand displays and marketing events were both good and bad for Native art. The exhibitions were successful in generating niche markets for particular things, she said. But the public didn't talk about expertise or technique, responding instead to the stereotypical fur, the feathers, and all that kind of thing. One non-Native art teacher also contributed to that stereotyping. Dorothy Dunn, who had studied several Native cultures, opened the first studio school at the Santa Fe Indian School in 1932. Dunn taught a technique she developed, the studio style. She believed that Native artists could all be gathered into one universal style. Paintings from this period are distinguished by their flat appearance, with no depth of field or any other realistic depictions and opaque earth tones. While Collier and Darnancourt were developing art as an economic driver, museums came into play as centers of Native art and as repositories for what many social scientists feared were vanishing tribal cultures. Classically trained curators started studying Native art and became known as experts in the genre. The two largest Indian markets in the U.S., Santa Fe in 1922 and the Heard Indian Fair and Market in 1958, were founded by non-Native museums. The Santa Fe Indian Market was first sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico, while the museum volunteers started the Heard Indian Fair. Other major Indian markets are also run by museums, including the Autry, the Idlejorg, and the Abbey. These moves, plus pressure from non-Indian collectors and gallery owners with a Eurocentric point of view, led to the current system, the Native American Industrial Art Complex, Miles said. Non-Natives step in and define our cultures and interpret our creative process, he said. Native art galleries put elite art on display. And gallery owner and Indian studies student Mark Bhatti said, museums are primarily interested in similar art, art that knocks your socks off. The quest for only premier art leaves most artists who produce good quality but not world-class works with little, if any, support system to sustain them and their families. Miles said that the current system is a machine that takes and sells art to others and each other. The system is a millstone on the business, he said, but it's hard to escape because it's the only game in town. It creates roadblocks and gatekeepers. And most importantly, said Miles, a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe, it all takes from Indian and collective agency. Young artists doing well. The small market to give Pueblo artists a place to sell their art in downtown Santa Fe, New Mexico, has grown into the nation's largest Indian market. Visitors and collectors attend parties, gallery openings, balls, fashion shows, and museums during Market Week, the third week in August. The market was once run by non-Natives, is now almost exclusively managed by Indigenous people as part of the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts, or SWAIA. Jamie Schulz, Executive Director of the Association, is Northern Cheyenne and Sisseton Wahpeton Oyati. The group's board chair, Don Hull, is an enrolled member of the Chippewa Cree Tribe of Montana. Schulz said the market is working to incorporate new arts while still honoring traditions. We redid our standards for 2025, she said. Even as older artists feel like they're being pushed out in favor of fashion shows, digital art, and other innovations, Scholz said the association is meeting the challenge of adding new innovations in a way that still honors traditional forms. The market itself still holds to its standards. But for those artists who want to change, at least two other alternative markets sprang up in town to supplement the Santa Fe market, which itself features more than 1,000 artists. For Scholz, the biggest takeaway is the joyousness she sees around town. "We see young artists entering the market for the first time that are doing well." And this article was entitled "How Native Art is Changing from Beads to Computers," and that was by Deborah Utasia Kroll. Moving on now to Valley and State News, this next article is from the Inspiration section of the paper. It is entitled "Latino Clothing Company Celebrates the Working Class." This is by David Uoa Jr. The Phoenix Suns debuted an Instagram reel on November 2, 2023 for their El Valle campaign that showcased the Phoenix Chicano community and its influence. The reel was overwhelmingly packed with local Chicano and Latino artists and business cameos that identifying each would have been difficult for anyone with just one first glance. The bold gold and black letters of Working Class Cultura's slogan, "Build Your Dreams," was one of many businesses featured in the video. Working Class Cultura is a Phoenix-based clothing brand that celebrates the hardworking spirit of the Latino community by allowing its customers to represent the brand instead of just one spokesperson or a select group of models. Ray Cruz, Puerto Rican and native to the Alhambra Village of the Central and West Phoenix area, founded and co-owns Working Class Cultura with his nephew and business partner, Frank Padilla, after taking a break from a previous business venture, Working Class Clothing. Burnout and lack of promotional support led Cruz to step away from that project in 2006. Years later, in 2014, Padilla would encourage him to bring it back, but under a new name and direction. In the early days of the company, when Working Class Cultura still went by Working Class Clothing, Cruz said he told his partner that if they were going to bring back the company, they needed to revamp the name. As they were trying to figure out how to make Working Class Clothing relevant, Cruz said he was working on several other projects in addition to building a company, like fixing up his home, as well as several cars and motorcycles. These projects helped him realize that working class people are the backbone of the Latino culture and community. They are the Working Class Cultura. A new brand and slogan were born. Cruz said that Working Class Cultura's slogan is a dedication to the working class people who put in work every day to make their dreams a reality. "You have this vision and you work that over time, or you're doing these extra things just to get into this one vision," I was like, "we're all really just trying to build our dream," Cruz said. And that article is entitled "Latino Clothing Company Celebrates the Working Class," and that was by David Uoa Jr. Our next article is entitled "This Is Why Mexican Food is Arizona's Favorite Cuisine." This is by Laura Daniela Sepulveda. Arizona's food culture has long held a special place for Mexican cuisine, and recent research confirmed it as the state's favorite culinary style and the most popular food business. A recent analysis by online small business lender On Deck, identifying the most popular type of restaurant by state and city, showed that Mexican restaurants were the most competitive food business both in Arizona and Phoenix among 31 other food business types. Multiple restaurants, shops, and trucks across Arizona have earned the love of locals through all manner of serving popular Mexican dishes, from birria tacos and carne asada burritos to Sonoran hot dogs and tamales. Some of these local favorites were featured in the Arizona Republic's Essential Restaurants of 2024 list. Yet the popularity of Mexican food extends beyond restaurants. Another study by Hello Millions found that Mexican cuisine leads online searches in Arizona. The study analyzed Google searches for different ways of enjoying international cuisines, whether by cooking at home, eating at a local restaurant, or enjoying a takeout meal. The number of searches was adjusted to each state's population to determine each state's most popular food type. Mexican food came out as the conclusive winner in Arizona, with an average of more than 50,000 Google searches per month, which is about 550 monthly searches per 100,000 people. The cultural cuisine also ranked as the nation's second most popular, generating an average of nearly 1 million monthly searches. And that article was titled, "This is Why Mexican Food is Arizona's Favorite Cuisine," and that was by Laura Daniela Sepulveda. We're approximately 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, November 24th, 2024. Continuing on with Valley and State News, this next article is entitled "Meth Lab No More, Why is State Still Making Headlines?" This is by Bill Goody-Kuntz. For a long time, Arizona was not always in the political spotlight. Or if it was for controversies like former Governor Evan Meacham, who was impeached and removed from office, or SB 1070, the legislation that made being in the country illegally a state crime and made it illegal to fail to carry immigration papers, among other things. How things have changed. Now, Arizona's a swing state. Presidential candidates visit as often as kids visit the dessert bar at an all-you-can-eat buffet. But some of those rough edges Stewart called out remain. The state is also ground zero for election denialism and conspiracy theories. Perhaps you remember the audit of the 2020 election? Good times. Jon Stewart put it pretty bluntly during his first stint on The Daily Show. He called Arizona the meth lab of democracy. Someone has to shine that spotlight, and it's the journalists from around the country who flock to the state, providing coverage like never before. TV, newspapers, magazines, everyone's getting in on it. So why is the national media obsessed with Arizona? This week on Valley 101, a podcast by the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com, we find out. The author spoke with George Packer, a reporter for the Atlantic magazine who wrote an epic story about Arizona, Vaughn Hilliard, a reporter for NBC News who grew up in Arizona, and Jack Healy, a New York Times reporter based in the state. And you can listen to this episode to the Valley 101 on your favorite podcast app. You can submit your questions to us about Metro Phoenix and Arizona for a chance to be chosen for the podcast. And that article is entitled "Meth Lab No More, Why is State Still Making Headlines?" Our next article is entitled "Zamora Subject of Documentary," with the subtitle "Goodyear Teacher Jailed for Relationship with Boy." This is by Lauren DeYoung. 5 years after being sentenced to prison, former Goodyear teacher Brittany Zamora's criminal case continues to capture public attention. Once a star teacher, then 27-year-old Zamora taught elementary school and fell from grace when she was caught sending illicit text messages to a 13-year-old male student over Instagram and other messaging platforms, months after a relationship began in 2018. When the boy's mom found the messages, Zamora was arrested on charges on molestation and sexual exploitation. As part of plea deal, Zamora later pleaded guilty to sexual conduct with a minor, attempted molestation, and public sexual indecency, according to court records. She was sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2019, the lowest possible sentence for the charges. A new documentary released Monday highlights body camera footage from the days leading up to her arrest, detailing interviews from parents, witnesses, school administrators, and Zamora herself. Here's what we know. What happened in Zamora's case? Brittany Zamora, a now 33-year-old former teacher from Goodyear, was arrested in March 2018 on suspicion of having a sexual relationship with her sixth-grade student at Las Brisas Academy. Police reports recounted how she, then 27, had sex with her student multiple times in her classroom and car, sometimes with an 11-year-old boy posing as a lookout in the classroom. The two even sexually touched each other while her sixth-grade class obliviously watched a video, according to police reports. In June 2019, Zamora pleaded guilty to sexual conduct with a minor, attempted molestation of a minor, and public sexual indecency as part of a plea deal. She was previously charged with 15 felony counts, including 8 counts of sexual misconduct with a minor and a slew of other charges. What was Zamora's sentence? Zamora was sentenced to serve a total of 20 years in prison and is expected to be released in 2038, according to the Arizona Department of Corrections. She will be on probation for the rest of her life and must register as a sex offender. Zamora received the lowest sentence possible for the crimes of which she was accused. The judge pointed to Zamora's lack of criminal history and the fact that screenings indicated she was unlikely to reoffend. Her attorney also highlighted a psychosexual evaluation that determined Zamora had no sexual interest in children, but suffered from anxiety and depression. The maximum possible sentence was 44 years. How did Zamora have a relationship with a student? The relationship between Zamora and the 13-year-old started when she told her 6th-grade students to message her on an instructional app called Classcraft because she was bored one day. Texts between Zamora and the 13-year-old quickly turned flirtatious and evolved into a sexual relationship, according to police. This relationship carried on for at least 3 months before a monitoring app on the student's cell phone alerted his parents to illicit texts between the two. The app, Sentry Parental Control, alerted the mom that the word baby was repeatedly coming up in a direct message conversation on Instagram. She quickly realized the Instagram account belonged to Zamora. The boy admitted to his parents that it was his teacher and that they had sex. In a police interview, the boy told police that Zamora sent a naked picture of herself and another of herself wearing lingerie. He told the police he also sent her pictures of himself naked. Zamora was arrested in March 2018 after the parents found the text messages. Months before her arrest, classmates noticed the strange relationship between their teacher and the boy. They thought they were too close, a police report noted, and rumors circulated that they were dating and that he had gotten her pregnant. Some students claimed that Zamora played favorites, and another student said Zamora grew too close with students, mentioning her attendance of out-of-school activities. Zamora frequently communicated with students outside of school through an Instagram account and Classcraft. Was anyone else involved? Alongside molesting the 13-year-old boy, police interviews show that Zamora could have been grooming another student. The mother of a male friend of the 13-year-old told police Zamora promised to send her son naked pictures over the summer. During class, Zamora asked the friend whether he was circumcised, the report said. She showed him pictures of male genitalia on her phone when he said he didn't understand the question. A lawsuit filed by the parents of the 13-year-old alleged that Zamora's husband and the Liberty Elementary School District knew about the sexual misconduct at least a month before the parents reported the abuse. The parents' lawsuit claims that 3 students in Zamora's class reported inappropriate behavior to Las Brisas Academy principal Timothy Dickey in written statements in early February 2018. Dickey later interviewed the students and lectured them on the dangers of rumors without referring the matter to police or alerting the boys' parents, according to the civil lawsuit. Zamora reassured Dickey that it was the victim who gravitated toward her, the report said. Zamora told Dickey he could check Classcraft to view the communications, but he never did. How does Zamora's husband fit into this? The parents' lawsuit claims that Zamora's husband, Daniel Zamora, knew about the relationship between his wife and the boy. On the night before her arrest, Zamora called the family to settle the matter and put her husband on the phone. Daniel Zamora didn't appear to know that the relationship went beyond a few text messages. He tried to defend his wife, saying she was a good teacher who would do anything to help her students, and pleaded with the boy's father not to call the cops. According to police reports, Daniel Zamora coached his wife during later calls with the parents, including on the day of her arrest. He encouraged her to cry, apologize, and do whatever she could to seem helpless. "Don't admit to any relationship," Daniel Zamora texted his wife, "because we both know there isn't one and nothing happened. to stupid fantasy text that went too far. The lawsuit was settled for an undisclosed amount in 2019. Who is Brittany Zamora? Zamora graduated from Arizona State University and took a teaching job at Littleton Elementary School in Avondale. She was awarded Teacher of the Year in 2016. She was then recruited to teach at Las Brisas Academy by the principal, Dickey. He previously served as the assistant principal at Littleton Elementary. Zamora surrendered her state teaching certificate in December 2018. Zamora is currently over 6 years into her 20-year sentence. She is scheduled to be released in 2038. During her time in prison, she divorced her husband and completed several work assignments. The newly released documentary can be seen via YouTube. And that article was entitled Zamora, Subject of Documentary, and that was by Lauren DeYoung. Our next article is entitled Why is Thanksgiving So Late This Year? What to Know? This is by Shelby Slade and Katie Landeck. Thanksgiving is just around the corner in the United States. Whether you're planning on cooking a feast, ordering your dinner to go, or eating at a restaurant, Thursday's holiday is a special opportunity to gather with loved ones while chowing down on a delicious plate of food. But why is Thanksgiving so late this year? With the holiday landing just a few days before the end of the month, it feels a bit tardy this year, especially with the radio already playing festive tunes and stores already decked out in holiday displays. It feels like Thanksgiving is closer than ever to Christmas. Here's what to know about when Thanksgiving is this year and how the date was determined. When is Thanksgiving and why is it so late this year? Thanksgiving falls on the fourth Thursday in November, determined by an act of Congress in 1941. Prior to that, the date of Thanksgiving was a bit of a political football. The first day of public Thanksgiving was on Thursday, November 26, 1789. For decades after that, the date and even the month of Thanksgiving moved around, with each president having to set the date every year. President Abraham Lincoln was the first to try to establish some order, declaring in 1863 that it would fall on the last day of November every year. That worked for a while, but in 1939, President Franklin D. Roosevelt became concerned when Thanksgiving was slated to fall on the last day of the month, potentially shortening Christmas shopping and stalling economic recovery. He moved the holiday to the second to last Thursday in November. That ended up splitting the country, with 32 states going along with the changes and 16 refusing to do so. Rhode Island was one of the states that refused to change it, according to the National Archives. When is the latest Thanksgiving can be? 2 years later, Congress got involved, fixing the date of Thanksgiving to the fourth Thursday in November, which took into account when the month has five Thursdays, so the holiday could no longer fall on the last day of the month. November 28th is the latest date on which Thanksgiving can fall. That article was entitled, Why is Thanksgiving So Late This Year? What to Know? And that was by Shelby Slade and Katie Landeck. We're going to move now to national and world news with articles from USA Today, and we'll start off with the two front page articles, one on the Trump nominations and the second on the UN Climate Summit. The first one on the UN Climate Summit is entitled, Developing Nations Blast COP29 Deal, with the subtitle, $300 billion finance target viewed as insufficient by intended recipients. This is by Kate Abnett, Valerie Volkovici, and Karen Strohecker. Countries at the COP29 summit in Baku adopted a $300 billion per year global finance target on Sunday to help poorer nations cope with impacts of climate change, a deal its intended recipients roundly criticized as woefully insufficient. The agreement, clinched in overtime at the two-week conference in Azerbaijan's capital, was meant to provide momentum for international efforts to curb global warming in a year destined to be the hottest on record. Some delegates gave the deal a standing ovation in the COP29 plenary hall, while others lambasted wealthy nations for not doing more and criticized the Azerbaijan host for hurriedly gaveling through the contentious plan. I regret to say that this document is nothing more than an optical illusion, Indian Delegation Representative Chandni Raina told the closing session of the summit minutes after the deal was gaveled in. This, in our opinion, will not address the enormity of the challenge we all face. Therefore, we oppose the adoption of this document. United Nations Climate Chief Simon Steele acknowledged the difficult negotiations that led to the agreement, but hailed the outcome as an insurance policy for humanity against global warming. It has been a difficult journey, but we've delivered a deal, Steele said. This deal will keep the clean energy boom growing and protect billions of lives. But like any insurance policy, it only works if the premiums are paid in full and on time. The agreement would provide $300 billion annually by 2030, boosting rich countries' previous commitment to provide $100 billion per year in climate finance by 2020. That earlier goal was met 2 years late in 2022 and expires in 2025. The deal also lays the groundwork for next year's climate summit to be held in the Amazon rainforest of Brazil, where countries are meant to map out the next decade of climate action. The summit cut to the heart of the debate over financial responsibility of industrialized nations, whose historic use of fossil fuels have caused the bulk of greenhouse gas emissions, to compensate others for worsening damage wrought by climate change. It also laid bare divisions between wealthy governments constrained by tight domestic budgets and developing nations reeling from costs of storms, floods, and droughts. Negotiations had been due to finish on Friday, but ran into overtime as representatives from nearly 200 countries struggled to reach consensus. Talks were interrupted Saturday as some developing countries and island nations walked away from the table in frustration. We are leaving with a small portion of the funding climate vulnerable countries urgently need. It isn't nearly enough, but it's a start, said Tina Steg, Marshall Islands climate envoy. Nations have been seeking financing to deliver on the Paris Agreement goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels, beyond which catastrophic climate impacts could occur. That target is slipping out of reach. The world is currently on track for as much as 3.1 degrees Celsius or 5.6 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by the end of this century, according to the 2024 UN Emissions Gap Report, with global greenhouse gas emissions and fossil fuels use continuing to rise. I had hoped for a more ambitious outcome, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said of the COP29 deal, but this agreement provides a base on which to build. The roster of countries required to contribute, about two dozen industrialized countries, including the U.S., European nations, and Canada, dates back to a list decided during the UN climate talks in 1992. European governments have demanded others join them in paying in, including China, the world's second biggest economy, and oil-rich Gulf states. The deal encourages developing countries to make contributions, but does not require them. The agreement also includes a broader goal of raising $1.3 trillion in climate finance annually by 2035, which would include funding from all public and private sources and which economists say matches the sum needed to address global warming. Countries also agreed on rules for a global market to buy and sell carbon credits that proponents say could mobilize billions more dollars into new projects to help fight global warming, from reforestation to deployment of clean energy technologies. Securing the climate finance deal was a challenge from the start. Donald Trump's U.S. presidential election victory this month has raised doubts among some negotiators that the world's largest economy would pay into any climate finance goal agreed in Baku. Trump, a Republican who takes office in January, has called climate change a hoax and promised to again remove the U.S. from international climate cooperation. Western governments have seen global warming slip down the list of national priorities amid surging geopolitical tensions, including Russia's war in Ukraine and expanding conflict in the Middle East and rising inflation. The showdown over finance for developing countries comes in a year that scientists say is destined to be the hottest on record. And that article was entitled, Developing Nations Blast COP29 Deal, and that was by Kate Abnett, Valerie Vokovici, and Karen Strohecker. Our next front page article from USA Today is entitled, Rollins Picked for Ag Secretary, with a subtitle, Job as Implications for American Diets and Wallets. This is by Reuters staff. President-elect Donald Trump has chosen Brooke Rollins, president of the America First Policy Institute, to be agricultural secretary. As our next Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke will spearhead the effort to protect American farmers who are truly the backbone of our country, Trump said in a statement on Saturday. If confirmed by the Senate, Rollins would lead a 100,000-person agency with offices in every county in the country, whose remit includes farm and nutrition programs, forestry, home and farm lending, food safety, rural development, agricultural research, trade, and more. It had a budget of $437.2 billion in 2024. The nominee's agenda would carry implications for American diets and wallets, both urban and rural. Department of Agriculture officials and staff negotiate trade deals, guide dietary recommendations, inspect meat, fight wildfires, and support rural broadband, among other activities. Brooke's commitment to support the American farmer, defense of American food self-sufficiency, and the restoration of agriculture-dependent American small towns is second to none, Trump said in the statement. The America First Policy Institute is a right-leaning think tank whose personnel have worked closely with Trump's campaign to help shape policy for his incoming administration. She chaired the Domestic Policy Council during Trump's first term. As Agriculture Secretary, Rollins would advise the administration on how and whether to implement clean fuel tax credits for biofuels at a time when the sector is hoping to grow through the production of sustainable aviation fuel. The nominee would also guide next year's renegotiation of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal in the shadow of disputes over Mexico's attempt to bar imports of genetically modified corn and Canada's dairy import quotas. Trump has said he again plans to institute sweeping tariffs that are likely to affect the farm sector. He was considering offering the role to former U.S. Senator Kelly Loeffler, a staunch ally whom he chose to co-chair his inaugural committee, CNN reported on Friday. Report: Bhattacharya is top candidate for NIH director. Meanwhile, Jay Bhattacharya is now the presumptive favorite to be selected by Trump as the next director of the National Institutes of Health, The Washington Post reported on Saturday, citing three people familiar with that matter. The Stanford-trained physician and economist met with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Trump's pick to lead HHS, last week, and impressed him with his ideas to overhaul NIH, the report said. Trump's transition team did not respond to a Reuters request for comment. Bhattacharya has called for shifting the agency's focus toward funding more innovative research and reducing the influence of some of its longest-serving career officials, the report added. The Department of Health and Human Services oversees NIH and other health agencies. And that article was entitled Rollins Picked for Ag Secretary, and that was by Reuters staff. In more world news, this next article is entitled Zelensky Says Russian Attacks Have Damaged 321 Port Facilities in Ukraine. This is by Reuters staff. Russian drone and missile attacks have damaged 321 Ukrainian port infrastructure facilities since July last year, President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Saturday. 20 merchant ships belonging to other countries were also damaged by Russian strikes, he added. Overall, Ukrainian food exports provide food for 400 million people in 100 countries around the world, Zelensky said. Food prices in Egypt, Libya, Nigeria, and other countries in Africa directly depend on whether farmers and agricultural companies in Ukraine can operate normally. Moscow has repeatedly denied that it attacks civilian targets. Ukraine is a major global wheat and corn grower, and before the Russian invasion, it exported about 6 million tons of grain per month via the Black Sea. When Russia launched its invasion in February 2022, it blockaded Ukraine's Black Sea ports. Shipments were resumed in July 2022 under the Black Sea Grain Initiative, a deal mediated by the United Nations and Turkey. But a year later, Russia exited the agreement. Since then, Ukraine has exported grain and other food products using its own corridor, which passes through the territorial waters of Romania, Bulgaria, and Turkey. Ukraine's grain exports in the July 2024 to June 2025 season totaled almost 16 million tons by the middle of November, up from about 11 million tons in the same period a year ago, data from traders and the government showed. Ukraine's grain exports in the 2023-2024 marketing season rose to about 51 million tons from 49.2 million tons the previous year. And that article is entitled, Zelensky Says Russian Attacks Have Damaged 321 Port Facilities in Ukraine. And that was by Reuters staff. And that concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, November 24th, 2024. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on-demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.